Well, Mark is telling us that there are large triangular-shaped objects. 600-footers. We'll be back with him. We'll check in more on this on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with Mark McClandish. Our guest. Okay, Mark, you got to tell us about this 600-foot triangular-shaped object, which so many people have witnessed. As a matter of fact, I'm broadcasting now in a cave near St. Louis. And several years ago, several officers, four of them from Milstead, Illinois, saw one of these. And I think it was parked near Scott Air Force Base. Might I be right on that?
Well, the actual base, I'm not really sure about. I've heard that there is a facility down near Florida where some of these things have been seen quite often as well. And also in upper state New York, the Hudson Valley sightings tend to go along with some of the descriptions that we've had of this particular type of craft. Now, the interesting thing here is that so many people are just not used to seeing airships anymore, like the Goodyear blimp, for example, is an airship. And it basically uses the buoyancy of a really lighter-than-air gas to keep it aloft.
Mm-hmm.
But since the advent of dirigibles, or blimps as they are sometimes called, many years ago in the late 1800s, early 1900s, the material science, the kinds of materials that went into the construction of these things have improved so much. You have materials now that are hundreds of times stronger than the kinds of materials that used to be used, maybe even 1,000 times stronger.
And lighter.
Yeah. Absolutely. And so when you look at the possibility of using materials that not only are stronger and lighter, but can be put together in such a way to create a strong structural fuselage or body of a vehicle like that with absolutely no steel whatsoever, you're talking about an aircraft that can lift a tremendous amount of weight and at the same time is almost completely invisible to radar. The radio frequency energy of the radar just simply goes right through it and doesn't reflect back off of it. And then if you augment that by coating it with some of the special paint that they used both on the SR-71 and on the stealth fighter, the so-called, I think it was called iron ball paint, which has particles suspended in the paint that absorb the radio frequency energy and actually sort of re-radiate it as heat. So it's dissipated, and it just converts the kind of energy and dissipates it as heat. But you take all those things and you combine them, and you have the ability to logistically to move a tremendous amount of men and material in a very stealthy way and very quietly.
And very slowly, though, isn't it?
Or I suppose the top speed of something like this would be probably in the regime of 350 to 400 miles an hour, which, by the way,
if you go back to the
Phoenix Lights sightings of, I think it was March 13th, 1997, over Phoenix, if you go and you chart all the locations and the times starting south of I think it was what is the air base in Las Vegas there? Nellis Air Force Base.
Nellis.
If you start at Henderson with the first sighting, you go down through Flagstaff or Prescott Payson, through the areas just north of Phoenix and down all the way to Tucson. If you chart, point to distance, you find that if the times are accurate based on the eyewitness accounts, this thing never traveled any faster than 450 miles an hour, which is fully within the capabilities of an aircraft of this kind. Even using internally buried jet engines with long sound-suppressed tubes that would allow the air to be sucked into the aircraft, into a jet engine, and then vented out through a discharge nozzle, perhaps up on the top of the vehicle, that can be rotated in multiple directions, just like the snorkels that they have on some of these hovercraft that are used over in Great Britain and other places. You can direct, it's called vectored thrust, and you can redirect the thrust from the engines that are buried deep inside the vehicle so that the sound is suppressed. They also have technology for acoustically canceling the noise from the jet engines by introducing a very loud signal that is basically 180 degrees out of sync with the noise that's produced by the jet engine. It completely cancels, in about 95% cancellation of the noise. You just don't hear anything.
Isn't it also painted on the bottom as if it's a star chart?
Well, you know, something that has been described on a number of occasions, that these vehicles either look like a soap bubble, they look like they were transparent, or they actually look like they had some kind of a lighting array on the bottom that generated a moving but artificial star field on the other side. Now, I actually spoke to an individual. I had a girlfriend who had a gallery in Big Bear Lake who a number of years ago opened the gallery, and I was there for that. And I met a number of people who actually worked at the Northrop B-2 bomber production facility. And we started talking about these kind of things. And one of the ladies said that one night that they had, in fact, seen one of these immense, 600-foot long, 350, 400-foot wide triangular-shaped things hovering right over Plant 42 in the Lancaster-Palmdale area. It was absolutely silent. And she had described this very thing, this feature that appeared to be sort of an active skin, if you will, that had, maybe some kind of LED lights or something built right into the skin. And so it could create a fake, an artificial star field.
Yeah.
that wouldn't necessarily match the star field that was directly above it, but that, by having this illusion of, stars of various magnitudes, some being faint, some being brighter, moving across the bottom of the aircraft at the same pace and in the opposite direction of the vehicle's travel, you could create the illusion that there was just nothing there. Aside from the fact that the Los Angeles area, including the Lancaster, Palmdale, Mojave area, gets an awful lot of smog from the Los Angeles basin. Mm-hmm. And so the city lights have a tendency to illuminate that smog, especially in the summertime and the fall. And so the sky has sort of this orange glow to it, and no matter how hard you try to shield the underside of a huge aircraft like that with a fake star field, it just happens to be silhouetted against this smog that goes up several thousand feet in altitude, and so it's
right.
Silhouetted as this big dark object. You just can't miss it.
How high up does this object go?
Well, there's some debate. I was told on one occasion by an employee from Lockheed that they had developed a new kind of silica-based aerogel that actually could be dispensed from the payload bay of the space shuttle while it was in outer space, and that this gel could be catalyzed and sprayed out into space, and these little bubbles of gas would expand into this almost like soap suds that would solidify into a very very soft but brittle kind of a glassy foam, if you will, a very very lightweight. And that these things could be encapsulated in these large sort of volutes or bags, I guess you'd call them, and that the bags themselves had a kind of thin wiring that ran along the length of the skin, the bag that would contain all of this stuff, and that by putting an electrical charge on these wires, they could actually make this thing fly down into the atmosphere and move around through the atmosphere like a giant floating compass needle, if you will. One of the experiments we did when we were little kids in school is you take a needle and you very gently lay it down on the water, and the surface tension will make it float. And if it's made out of steel or iron, the needle will actually turn around and point in the direction of the North Pole. So if you put an electrical charge on an object of this size, even if it's a relatively minor electric charge, and you augment that by the static electricity that builds up as this body, this huge thing, begins to pass down through the air, it's very possible to be using the movement of air over the surface to create an electrostatic charge that actually powers your flight control system. I mean, it's remarkable the things that they can do.
Mark, the craft that you'd mentioned last hour that went about 17,000 miles an hour,
yes.
What kind of propulsion system do you think it had?
Now, that particular aircraft, I eventually was told that it actually had three different propulsion systems. The one was basically sort of a high-bypass turbojet engine, kind of like what you would find in the old SR-71 Blackbird, buried up inside the fuselage. And then the early versions had what amounted to what has been called a linear aerospike engine. The whole back end of the aircraft was sort of like a tapered but flattened out cone, and they would spray fuel from a ridge that ran laterally across the aircraft. And as soon as it hit this extremely high-pressure, high-speed, superheated air flowing over the front of the aircraft, it would spontaneously explode, and it would expand. The exploding fuel would expand between the tapered afterbody of the vehicle and the supersonic shockwave that would slant back and away from this ridge, the point of separation, and would actually push this thing forward. Now, in a previous program with Art, I had mentioned that this was kind of like taking a wet pumpkin seed and squeezing it between your fingers. You know, by putting the pressure both above and below the afterbody of the aircraft, you put pressure on it, you can push it forward at a tremendous velocity. Someone heard that particular statement, and they thought that the code name for the vehicle was the pumpkin seed. Well, it's not. That was just something that someone picked up and began circulating. So that is not the name. It was actually called the Lockheed Pulsar, I believe. But it came under a family of aircraft that later became known as Aurora.
That's right, and we've heard a lot about that. Well, now, everything that you have handled, Mark, or investigated, at any point, did you stumble across aliens, for example, that might have been captured or contained?
Well, I did. And not that I ever actually saw any of these things personally myself, but part of my logic, once one of the other things that had occurred in this business with Norton Air Force Base and the exhibit that was given at the Lockheed Skunk Works was that there were also three flying saucers on display there. Approximately 24, 60, and about 120 to 130 feet in diameter, all hovering off the floor with nothing suspending them in the way of cables from the ceiling or landing gear, and they were referred to as alien reproduction vehicles. Now, there have been a number of people who've called into question the veracity, the honesty of the eyewitness, and you know, it might be easy to discount this story entirely, except that there are probably a dozen other people that I've talked to who either have worked on this thing, have seen it, or have relatives who have worked on it. And so there's no question in my mind that it actually exists. But the real question is whether or not it was back-engineered from technology that was captured at some time in the past, in the U.S. history's past, probably, you know, something dating back to the 1940s, 1945 to 1947.
Roswell, do you think?
Well, that's one possibility. Interestingly, there's sort of a tie-in between stealth and those original incidents, because one of the few kinds of radar systems that has the potential of detecting a stealth aircraft, and there was a lot of question about how effective the Northrop B-2 bomber would be, because there was a radar system under development that was called UWB. It was ultra wideband radar, and because it broadcasts on a number of frequencies simultaneously, it has the ability to sort of silhouette the target, even if the target has the ability to limit radar reflectivity, even absorbing some of the reflectivity, because of the fact that it's broadcasting on a number of frequencies simultaneously, it has the ability to sort of isolate this pocket that doesn't reflect anything.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it turns out that the very first and the most rudimentary radar systems that the U.S. military developed, which happened to be down in the area of Mexico and Four Corners, where the Utah, New Mexico, Arizona, and Colorado come together, was a radar system that had this unusual characteristic. Because it was so rudimentary, because they hadn't refined the technology, it just happened to have the ability to broadcast on a number of frequencies very sort of in a dirty way, you know, sort of staticky, if you will, in terms of the terminology that you'd want to use. But because of that, it's been discussed and rumored, and some people have claimed that it was this very aspect of the radar's transmission, this multispectral wide spectrum broadcast, that had the ability to jam the control systems of some of these vehicles that started showing up in the skies of Earth after we began detonating nuclear weapons. Now, the story goes that something about the way that we built these weapons, the way they went off, the electromagnetic nuclear pulse, sent out a signal, a signature, if you will, that told somebody somewhere else, maybe in the next star system over, that, hey, the boys on Earth have crack the atom finally. We need to go check out their progress and see if they're going to destroy themselves.
Right, they're coming along. Exactly.
And so if you look at the time between the first detonations of nuclear weapons, probably, I don't remember the exact, the first test I think was in 1944, and the first actual use in warfare was, I believe, August of 1945. But, you know, you look at that, and it's 1947, which is supposedly the first downed extraterrestrial vehicle at Roswell. It's 2 years later. And so if you look at the distances between stars and the possibility of traveling at superluminal or faster-than-light speeds, you know, you have the potential of having somebody from somewhere else saying, you know, this is, we need to go there and see what the guys on Earth are doing. But so Roswell wasn't the only incident. There were also incidents, crashes that occurred at Aztec, New Mexico, a site which I've actually visited. Roswell, Socorro, New Mexico, or is it Mexico? I forget. Paradise, Arizona. There was one near somewhere near Flagstaff, I believe it was as well. So, but if you look at these, and they all sort of form a circle around the area where these radar tests were being done, and so it tends to make one believe that there really was something to the story about this particular kind of air radar interfering with their guidance control systems.
It is amazing, that story and all the others too, Mark, isn't it?
Well, I find that when this all started, I was really quite skeptical. I felt that perhaps, you know, one of these early scientists like Nikola Tesla or someone who actually described aircraft designs, he called using an electron wind. And if you look at some of the designs that were published, some of the things that he had proposed, they bear a striking resemblance to the components that are now alleged to be a part of these propulsion systems, which I'll be able to describe in one of the next segments. You know, my skepticism led me to look everywhere, not just in the aerospace industry, not just people who said they'd seen lights in the sky, but, you know, people who were also claiming to be part of the abduction phenomenon. My logic, my thinking was that if these people really had been abducted and they really were awake during any part of that experience, there was a slight possibility that maybe they saw some of these propulsion system components.
Sure.
And in fact, after hearing the description of what the components in the alien reproduction vehicle were actually supposed to look like, and without really ever disclosing some of those facts to the people that I interviewed who were claiming to be abductees,
right.
It was startling, very startling, just how close they got to describing some of those components that were allegedly a part of the ARV, the alien reproduction vehicle's propulsion system. I mean, one of the most pronounced features is a large central column that runs right up through the middle of the vehicle.
Does it rotate?
I beg your pardon?
Does it rotate?
In some cases, it does. It depends on the kind of propulsion system. In the case of the ones that were witnessed in these alien craft, there was actually an inner and an outer column which rotated, counter-rotated in opposite directions. Now, if you, I think it was Nick Pope, was it Timothy Good, wrote a book, I think it was called Above Top Secret.
That was Timothy.
Yes. He had described finding some research that was being done by the Nazis up in the, I think it was the Wenceslas mine in Poland, that involved an object called the Bell. And it actually employed a system very much like this with a couple of counter-rotating cylinders that were buried inside of a ceramic sort of bell-shaped device using mercury, thorium, and beryllium peroxide, which just happened to be some of the same kind of components that have been described as having been used in these propulsion systems. And so, I began to think that maybe some of these people who were claiming that they had been abducted by aliens really were onto something, that they were not just making this stuff up.
All right, stay with us. Back with more in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. We'll take your phone calls next hour with our guest Mark McClendish. I'll be right back with him, though, in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Coast with Mark McClendish. Mark, what are you working on now these days?
Well, I've actually got a custom car project I'm working on. I'm doing some design work in that area. I'm also doing a series of illustrations for a major boat manufacturer. And I've got a few other projects I really can't talk about that I'm working on that are very interesting. But I'm actually thinking of branching out and more into an area of science fiction and fantasy, fantastic art, I think they call it, the kind of stuff that Frank Frazetta and others like him have done. And looking forward to that.
I'm going to get you in touch with Larry Niven, one of the great science fiction writers.
Well, that'd be great. I love science fiction.
Yeah, we can do things like that for you.
Yeah, that would be great.
This whole picture that you've looked at over the years is leading you to come away with what kind of a question and then what kind of an answer?
Well, I think the question on everybody's mind about this sort of technology is, if it exists, why is it still secret? I mean, if it's been, 47 to 2006, we're looking at, 60 years or something?
Yeah, what are we holding back for?
This is the same sort of question I think you posed to me the last time we were here, and I think the answer is still the same, and that is that the technology that they have, and it really does exist, is the one thing that gives us a strategic edge in the world with nations like Iran threatening to develop nuclear weapons and throw them at their neighbors, the prospects of North Korea doing something like that as well, the idea that we might attack one of these countries, and frankly, the prospect of doing that is ludicrous. In spite of whatever the Kim Jong Il thinks, it'd be silly for us to do that because their fallout would all drift back to Canada, the United States, with the prevailing winds. So it's not like we're going to do that tomorrow. But so the real question remains: if they have the technology, why is it secret? Why haven't we heard about it? Why aren't they using it commercially? And as far as I'm aware, there are a number of efforts being made right now, not only in this country but around the world, to try and find a way to bring out this technology in a way that doesn't threaten its military applications and at the same time allows for things like power production without the toxic byproducts that you get from fossil fuels, power production without the radioactivity that you find with nuclear power plants, and power production that can be taken and modularized and moved out into remote areas where people living in little communities in third world countries would be able to use, something the size of a couple of suitcases to produce energy for an entire village.
Sounds like Tesla would have been happy, Mark.
Oh, he would have. This is exactly the kind of thing that I think that he probably eventually visualized with the project that he had at Wardenclyffe, this giant tower that was basically kicking the Earth's electromagnetic field in such a way that it would be in resonance, and then if you tune to a particular frequency by driving a stake into the ground and putting an antenna up in the air, that you could tune into the same frequency and draw energy from it to power whatever your local needs might be. I think even Art Bell has talked about the antenna system that he had when he was living in Pahrump, by driving something that would thwart lightning strikes into the ground and then having a wire way up in the air, that he was actually able to get a certain amount of voltage off the wires that came from his antenna. And this was, not some kind of radio signal that was coming in, but it was actually an electrical differential between the wire that's up in the sky and the Earth itself.
I think he was putting power back on the grid, too, wasn't he?
Well, that I don't know about. I mean, I know that he had a number of systems that he might have even been using some kind of a photovoltaic array, solar cells to help generate electricity. I'm really not that familiar
with it. I'm sure he did, though.
Well, it certainly is possible. I mean, out in the desert like that, there's plenty of sunshine to draw from.
Mark, the anti-gravity propulsion, how serious have we been in trying to develop that? Have we developed that?
Well, I don't know if anti-gravity is the correct term. There's been a little bit of debate about what exactly to call it. Some refer to it as a kind of a mass drive or a mass cancellation drive. Anti-gravity is kind of a sort of a common term for the particular system, but the characteristics of this thing performing or operating are really they are you see the kinds of performance that are often reported with UFOs, and that is that you have things that are moving at tremendous velocities. They're not producing any kind of supersonic shock wave. They're making accelerations from a complete stop to thousands of miles an hour in you know, just a few seconds, if almost instantly, sometimes appearing as though they just completely disappear from view rather than actually moving away. They just move away so fast, it looks like they just wink out.
So it's not like they go through a different portal.
Well, you know, that is one of the aspects that is seen with some of the systems. Now, just like we have all different kinds of ways of making airplanes fly, whether it's with a jet engine, a scramjet engine, or a propeller, I'm sure that there's probably at least two or three different ways to make an anti-gravity propulsion system work. Just to give you an example, one of the witnesses that I encountered after the last show was a fellow who had been part of a special ops team that was operating inside East Germany right before the Berlin Wall came and came down in May of 1989, and he and his team were redirected to a crash site of a U.S. Reconnaissance aircraft that had crashed about 25 miles southeast of Halle, East Germany, which is right near Leipzig. It's just a few kilometers over the border. And he and his crew came in by helicopter and were escorted by a number of other, like Apache or those sort of fully armed combat-type helicopters. And the vehicle that he found on the ground was one of these flying triangles, but it was of a different type completely than from what any other thing that I've heard of in the past. This one, imagine a sort of shallow three-sided pyramid with one particular corner, one particular point going out quite a bit longer than the other two sides. And it was approximately, the best estimate that we've made was that it was about 12 to 13 feet wide at the leading edge, which was sort of the base of the triangle, if you will, like an arrowhead flying backwards, if you...
That's pretty small, though, isn't it?
And I'm sorry?
That's pretty small, isn't it?
Well, in this particular case, it was not a very big aircraft. It was a two-man vehicle. It was about 20 to 24 feet in length, maybe 12 to 13 feet wide. Had a cockpit remarkably similar to a stealth fighter, with sort of a sawtooth edge on the lip of the canopy. Had an interior cockpit that looked an awful lot like an F-16. But the thing that set it apart and made it have some elements in common with a lot of other these triangled sightings was that under each corner it had a sphere. Now, this is something that was reported in Denmark when they had the sightings back in the 1990s. It's been reported in parts of the southern United States, a number of areas. But there's only been a handful of sightings where the triangle actually looked as though it was an arrowhead flying backwards through the air. Most of the time, it looks like, you know, your typical delta wing aircraft where the pointy part of the aircraft is in the lead. In this case, it was just the opposite. And the thing that was interesting was that the aircraft had been flying a nap of the earth mission, you know, where you go down in the valleys and stuff to avoid detection as much as possible. And coming up over a rise, the aircraft had clipped the left front corner with the top of a pine tree, severing about 10 to 15 feet of that tree, and then crashing into a hillside, landing tail first, breaking the tail up and forward, kind of like the tail of a scorpion. And as it did so, the third sphere that was back near the tail section actually was broken free and was floating around the field near where the crash occurred. And the soldier that I interviewed, now retired, indicated that his particular assignment, his group, was to go out and to recover this sphere. Now, he described the sphere as looking like a white a pumpkin. He said he almost got the impression that it was made of kind of a sort of a white translucent plastic or glass, mm-hmm. and it was striated like a pumpkin would be, you know, with the little seams that run from the top to the bottom, converging at the top and the bottom. he indicated that each one of the ridges that ran from top to bottom had an additional set of scalloping, kind of like the scales on the back of a scallop shell, or the terracotta tiles, the curved terracotta tiles that you see on the roof of the old mission style architecture from Southern California, from the turn of the century. But he said that the object was all white, that it was spinning furiously like a wobbly, crazy top. And he said right on the top of it was a sort of what looked like a silver steel sphere that was flush with the top of it, and it looked like it had sort of a single wire coming out of the top of it. Now, the interesting thing here is that if you go back and you look at some of the earlier UFO cases, like the Tahunga Kangan sightings northwest of Los Angeles from the 60s, 70s, some in the 80s, one of the abductees who had written a book about this particular series of events described a propulsion system that she had seen while she was abducted that involved glass components to the propulsion system. And one of the features of that was that there was a liquid with some kind of suspended particles that would spin inside of a glass container. And by having a sort of like a propeller-like appliance on the inside, spinning this mixture of particles on the inside of this glass containment vessel, that it would create a tremendous amount of static electricity that was then redirected and used to propel the aircraft. And so it looks as though, from what this fellow has described to me, is that this particular aircraft used something, some sort of spin-off of that, pardon the pun, of the same kind of technology, and that this was somehow what helped this thing to move about.
Well, I got to tell you, there's a lot going on out there, Mark, and again, the big question is why isn't it ever revealed? Part of us, who are believers, just think that the technology may not be mastered yet. Maybe that's why.
Well, there have been a number of reported crashes. I think Bob Lazar talked about some of those kinds of events occurring. And it only stands to reason in any kind of early flight test program, whether it's a conventional aircraft or something really exotic like, something that uses anti-gravity, that you're going to have times where the pilot, either because his senses are somehow impaired by the field that is created by this propulsion system, he may not be able to really understand where he is in time and space in terms of his position above the ground, how fast he's going. Imagine if you have a propulsion system that completely eliminates the weight of the aircraft or completely cancels the mass of the aircraft.
Right.
It means that everything in the aircraft, including the pilot, has the sensation of being weightless. Now, you've heard of the Vomit Comet, the training aircraft. It's a KC-135 or C-135 that is like a 707 that the military takes, and they fly it up in an arching trajectory, which kind of goes up and then drops off the far side. And as it's descending, anyone who's inside becomes weightless, and they float
Yes.
around, and they can train the astronauts to as to what it would be like to be in a weightless environment.
Exactly.
Well, imagine trying to control an aircraft when you feel completely weightless. In one of the orientation rides that I had in an F-4 Phantom back in the 1980s, the pilot pushed the nose over in the same kind of thing into a negative G kind of situation, is what they call it, negative G forces. And every little particle of dust in the whole cockpit became airborne. It looked like it was smoking in the cockpit from the dust that rose up out of every little nook and cranny
Sure.
Around the ejection seat and everything else. And so when you imagine a pilot and everything in the cockpit that suddenly becomes weightless, it takes a tremendous amount of training to be able to teach someone how to fly an aircraft that has that kind of an effect on your body. I mean, even the early days of propeller-driven aircraft, when they began to understand what G-forces were about, before they had G-suits that would, basically squeeze your legs and your abdomen to keep the blood pressure to your brain up and prevent you from passing out. These were things that they had to learn about, trial and error. And so as time went on, I mean, it's like anything else. You go from a Model T to a Corvette, built in 1999, 2006, whatever. You're talking about a tremendous advancement in technology from one to the other. And I think the same is probably true of any alien aircraft that comes from another world or something that we're developing here, that there's a learning curve, that over time, even the designs that people report seeing have changed. They've gotten more sophisticated. They've become shinier, smoother, more aerodynamic, capable of things that the early sightings never would have imagined. They never would have suggested by the performance that we saw back in the 40s and the 50s and the stuff we see now, especially some of the sightings that have been filmed down near Gulf Breeze, where you see a silver disc in the sky and then it's gone. It's gone so fast. It almost looks as though it disappeared.
Yeah, you know, you're right about it, and it defies logic. Are you at a belief where you believe these craft are physical as opposed to multidimensional?
Well, you know, I it's interesting because I think that there's an aspect of both of those types of characteristics occurring not only within the same kind of vehicle, but also in the different types of vehicles that have been described. I met a former B-52 navigator at an air show at El Toro right before the base was closed in Southern California, down near Tustin, where he described a sighting. His B-52 had been damaged by a surface-to-air missile, and they had been in Guam for a couple of weeks while the aircraft was being repaired. And as they're flying back to their base near South Vietnam, one of the pilots called out that there was something really strange pacing their aircraft. And he said, we looked out the window, and here we are, you know, over the Pacific Ocean, not a cloud in the sky. It's 1 o'clock in the morning. There's a full moon directly south of us. And he said that here was this vehicle, this saucer-shaped aircraft that had to have been conservatively estimated between a quarter of a mile and a half a mile in diameter. And he said, and the way they kind of figured this out was the fact that it had a dome that looked like a single giant casting of transparent lucite glowing. And he says, we could see the shadows, the floors of each floor inside of this dome. And he says, we counted 27 stories. And he said, we could see the shadows and silhouettes of little people walking around in there. And he says, and so if you took the 27-story-tall dome and you laid it over on its side and then you sort of, you know, lay those that length end-to-end and you measure it out and you figure, well, 27-story building times 10 or 15, that might be, you know, between a quarter of a mile and a half a mile in diameter. Now, he said that they saw a number of features of this thing. They flew all around it, and because the electronics in the B-52 is shielded against the electromagnetic nuclear pulse that's produced by nuclear weapons if they go off,
exactly.
They felt that their electronics were shielded, and that was why they were able to get so close to this thing. But he said this was something that the scientists and the FBI were very interested in when they were debriefed after this mission, was that when this thing departed, when it flew away from them, he said this thing spooled up and it left within, it was out of sight within 2 or 3 seconds, but he said in its wake was this shimmering tube that looked like a tunnel. And he says, and in that tunnel, inside of this, we could see what appeared to be a daylit sky with clouds. And he says, we got the distinct impression that what we were able to see, we were looking through this like a wormhole that this craft had created that allowed it to travel almost instantaneously around to the far side of the earth where the sun was shining and there was a cloud-filled sky.
That's amazing. Isn't that incredible?
Oh, it's stunning.
God.
It's stunning. I mean, and to think that a craft that size could accelerate and disappear from view in just a few seconds. I mean, you obviously have to have a system of propulsion that cancels the weight and the mass of the aircraft so that it's the whole thing becomes like just a big feather that you're pushing along with a tremendous amount of power.
We're going to talk a little bit about that down F-89C Scorpion. Remember that case, Mark?
Looking forward to that.
We'll be back with you in a moment.